History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've realized they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and invest some time to listen as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And boy, are we in for some stories today with World War II veteran Ed Bates, who just turned 98. He would go on to a long career in law enforcement, even elected multiple times as sheriff in California's Madera County. But in World War II, he served first in the Merchant Marine, then in the Navy. Let's have him start us off with his childhood in Modesto, California.
Well, it was during the Depression. Wall Street guys were jumping out of their Wall Street apartments to kill themselves. Things were that bad. And my dad and his brother owned a blacksmith shop, and the farmers couldn't pay them. So they would go out and work on farms and get paid with crops. So he would come home, my dad would come home with a pickup load of carrots, and that's what we ate. We ate carrots fried, boiled, cooked in stew, and everything you can think of. And by the time I was 9 years old, I had a route in Modesto, going door to door on every Saturday, mowing people's lawns. I could make 5 cents for mowing the front lawn, 5 cents for making the back lawn. That gave me 10 cents. And I thought at the time, this is a great system. All I have to do is go out and find somebody that'll hire me. And if I work and they give me money, I thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened. So that's my earliest memories. And then, of course, by the time I was 11, I had two sisters. They were older than I. My dad was concerned about what I was going to do when I got in high school, if this depression was going to continue. He was concerned about my education. And his older sister was a teacher in Honolulu, Hawaii, and so was her husband. So they worked a deal. We had too many children and no money, and they had money and no children. So I found myself on a steamship alone, going over to Hawaii at a ball. Lived over there with them until just prior to World War II. Everybody in Hawaii knew that the war was coming with Japan. One of the common jokes when my aunt and uncle were playing bridge with other people, everybody had a gardener, a Japanese gardener, and a house person. The joke was, lady of the house said, "Tanaka, when the war comes, you wouldn't harm Missy, would you?" And his answer was, "No, no, no, Missy, that's the gardener's job." So that everybody knew it was coming. All my friends, their fathers were officers in the Navy. So I spent a lot of my time. I was on the USS Arizona, for example. I was on the submarine Argonaut that later went down with all hands. His dad was commanding officer, my buddy. So everybody knew the war was coming. So I went back home to do my junior year in high school. But I saw on November 3rd, 1941, I was finishing my junior year in high school. I turned 16. The next month, the war broke out. So I forged a Bible, hitchhiked up to San Francisco, told my parents I was going to get a summer job with another relative up in the foothills of Napa County, but tried to join the Marines. But I made a mistake. I wrote in the front of this book in old brown ink, "Born this day to son." I dated it 1923, which would have made me 18. But this Marine sergeant happened to look through it, asked me if I believed in miracles. And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm a Christian. I believe in miracles." He said, "Well, your dad filled this out when you were born?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, it says you were born in 1923. But the Bible wasn't printed until 1936. He said, "What do you say about that?" I said, "It's a miracle." He said, "No, you come back in 2 years." I said, "I'm not coming back in 2 years. Our forces are getting beat everywhere. Bataan Death March, Wake Island, everything. Our Navy had been defeated at Pearl Harbor. I said, I'm going in now. So he sent me across the street. It wasn't really a recruiting. You just went over and got your seaman papers as a merchant seaman. And 7 days later, I had my papers, and I was on a steamship going out to the Pacific, carrying munitions underneath the San Francisco Bay Bridge. I had been an Eagle Scout, so I knew the compasses. I knew how to box a compass. That's all the points. And I could splice line, tie knots. And when they asked me, well, have you shipped out before? I said, yes, on the SS Lurline. Where did you go? I said, well, went over the Hawaiian Islands and back. I didn't tell them I was 11 years old. So I found myself aboard ship, and there we were. So I spent my time in the Pacific unloading supplies, and then we went through the Panama Canal, going over to Guantanamo Bay, which is a big naval base at that time, and still is. German submarines were operating almost without any opposition. This was just 7 months after the war broke out. Sinking ships, they sunk in the months of July, August, and September of 1942. Just in the South Atlantic alone, they sunk 93 ships. It was just open stuff. So anyway, to make a long story short, when our ship had to go into Tampa, Florida to have some repairs done, I jumped ship and joined the Navy. By that time, I was 17, and they were glad to take a guy who was already an experienced seaman.
Well, and I want to come back to that moment, but I don't want to miss something that happened in the midst of that, because you shared with us at 11 years old, you go by yourself to Hawaii, you spend the next several years there, you leave not long before the attack on Pearl Harbor. And you told us you'd been on the Arizona, you'd been on the Argonaut, you'd been around all these sailors in Pearl Harbor. So I'm just curious what it was like for you when you heard that news that Pearl Harbor had been attacked and so many lives had been lost.
Well, I wondered whether some of my friends, were killed. One of my high school friends, his father was a chief petty officer on a ship. So he had just bought a brand new 1941 Chevrolet Club Coupe. He got in it to go down to get to his ship, and it was machine gunned. He jumped out, made it to the ship, but the ship was sunk. And I talked to my friend, who later became an officer in the U.S. Air Force, Army Air Corps at that time. He took his little sister and put her in a washing machine and put the top on. That was the only place he could think of to try to protect her. So that's why, as soon as the war broke out, I wasn't going to wait. I had already contacted Governor Olson, who was governor of the state of California at that time, through my father, and the local congressman, who I think his name was Jerrison, had made arrangements that as soon as I finished my senior year, I was going to Annapolis. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go over there and kill Japanese soldiers and sailors.
And a lot of guys have shared with me where they were when they found out the attack on Pearl Harbor had happened. Do you have a memory of that, of where you were and how you heard it?
It was on a Sunday. Times were tough, as I told you. I had a friend of mine that had a car. He was a senior. We got our .22 rifles and went up in the foothills to kill cottontails, rabbits. He had a radio in his car. We heard about it, so we went right back home quick. Right away, the military put out a broadcast. Anybody between the ages of 15, I think, and 45 or something, 50, who had a rifle, they wanted us to go down to the Modesto Airport, which was just a little, at that time, no commercial stuff, to join the State Guard. They wanted us to guard Don Pedro Dam and also the railroad against sabotage. So I went down there. They swore us in. I had my rifle. I had a 30-30 Winchester saddle rifle, a box of ammunition, and I said, what are we supposed to do? The sergeant said, in the State Guard, at that time I think they called it State Militia, but anyway, he said, well, if you see any Japanese paratroopers, shoot them. I said, okay. Well, nothing ever, but of course I went into service then, so I was later on, I was up in the Aleutian Islands on an island. I got a letter from the State Guard, said, you have failed to report for duty. We've tried to contact you 3 or 4 times, and if you don't report next Sunday or Saturday or whenever it was, we'll send the military police out to get you. So I sent them back a letter and said, please do.
Yeah, it's all relative. You know, you mentioned some of the jokes in Hawaii about, you know, well, that's the gardener's job and all of that. But then you come back to the States, and I know you weren't here too long, but I'm just curious, did you have any friends in California or Hawaii who were Japanese American.
Indeed, I did. And I thought it was very strange that the government would cause people of Japanese ancestry here in California, for example, to be sent to relocation places. One of my friends in Hawaii had asked me if he came to Modesto because there was a famous guy at Modesto High School who was a leader in following Sousa's band, which was a national boys band, and he was a trumpet player. And he said, I have a chance to be trained with this man. And Modesto, he said, are people there prejudiced? I said, oh, of course not. No way. So he came over. His family stayed in Hawaii. They didn't impress them. But he got called in and put in a camp. It was a strange situation. Now, on the other hand, I understand what was happening. In San Francisco, the papers reported, at least, that any Asian walking down the street was being attacked, whether they were Filipino or Chinese or Indonesian or whatever they were. It was dangerous for them. I talked to my father. His grandfather on one side was from Germany, and so his grandmother was too on that side. And during World War I, people would come up and throw yellow paint at their house and stuff, but just because they had a German last name. So people react emotionally in different ways. But you have to understand that this was such a sudden attack. Most people in the Midwest and places like that, in little towns, never heard of Pearl Harbor, didn't know what they were talking about. So it was a bad time, and I suppose we're having it right now. So some people, for whatever reasons, escapes me, are prejudiced about that kind of thing. It doesn't bother me a bit. I've learned in the service that you can only respect people on what they do and not what they look like.
I know we're bouncing around. Let's go back to this 16-year-old that's in the Merchant Marine. And you told us how many ships had been sunk by U-boats. Were you afraid? Were you concerned that could happen to your ship?
I didn't have enough brains to be concerned about anything. I thought it was a great, great adventure. One ship did get sunk alongside of us. The only thing that bothered me was we didn't have any escorts. We didn't have any guns. So the reason this ship was en route through the Panama Canal, we were en route to Philadelphia Naval Yard to have a naval gun crew put aboard and guns put on. And so we went into Tampa, Florida first from Cuba in order to have quarters placed for this Navy gun crew. We had an old 30 caliber Lewis machine gun from World War I. That's the only weapon we had, and I fired it. And it was so, the barrels were burned out so bad that every fifth round is a tracer, so you can trace where your bullets are going. This one would go shoot out maybe 100 yards, and then they were in all directions. There wasn't nothing to shoot at anyway except torpedoes, and they were underneath the water. So, no, I wasn't afraid. And for whatever reasons, I now believe that it was because I was under the protection of Jesus Christ. But at the time, I didn't believe that. I just believed that I was, nothing could happen to me. And I believed that all through law enforcement. Guys used to say, Ed, you're crazy to go charging into those places. We didn't have SWAT teams in those days. Crazy things happen during wars.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a crazy thing Ed Bates did that would lead to the most important relationship in his life. You can find photos and a short video with this newly minted 98-year-old at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll come right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 98-year-old Ed Bates of Clovis, California, originally from Modesto, California. He actually lived on Oahu as a teenager, moving back to the Golden State just before Imperial Japan attacked. He dropped out of school at 16 and tried to join the Marine Corps, but we heard that story of how his attempt at forging his birth date was foiled. He ended up in the Merchant Marine very early on in World War II when the U-boat threat was the greatest. That's an experience in itself, but you told us when you get to Tampa, you decide to jump ship and join the Navy.
Yeah.
So did you tell anybody that's what you were doing?
No. The first mate said... Well, as soon as we get the new, of course, they took us off the ship right away, and we went into a hotel. And he said, "Now, you're continuing with us, aren't you?" I said, "Oh, as soon as that Navy crew gets on there, yeah, I'll be all right with you." So that was the end of that.
And did you have any idea whether there would be consequences for that?
No, they couldn't do anything about that. I was a merchant seaman. In those days, there was no such thing as an organized merchant marine. If you had your seaman papers, which I had, because I was a seaman having sailed to Hawaii and back, and I could tie all the lines and knots and what have you. So I reported aboard ship in San Francisco with this letter. I gave it to the bosun who came, who couldn't speak English. He said, "The officers won't be here till 3 o'clock in the morning." Handed me an oil can, big long oil can. Said, "Oil winches." "Yes, sir." So I'm standing there, and a longshoreman, we were taking on ammunition. A longshoreman, older man, about 40 years old, said, "What's the trouble, son?" I said, "I'm supposed to oil the winches." He said, "Well, start oiling them." I said, "I don't know how to do that." So he showed me. So all night long, I oiled winches. That's the oiling for the spars and stuff that operate the booms. So then 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, here came this officer, first mate, had someone else take my place, and he said, "The American flag on the forepeak up there is fouled." He read this letter from the shipping company that I had gone to, and he said, "Go up there and clear that." I said, "Yes, sir." So I climb up this ladder, up on the mast as high as I could go. I hit a big spar. You couldn't get above it. So I grabbed hold of it, jockeyed myself up, stood up on it. I'm about 90 feet above the dock and the ocean on one side. I worked the thing. There was nothing wrong with it. So I crawled back down. He said, "Report me back to me at the quarter deck." When I reported back to them, I saw that he and another officer were watching me on binoculars. And as I approached them, they were smiling. He says, "Did you fix that foul up there?" I said, "Sir, that flag is working fine now." It always was. They just wanted to test me. So he says, "Come with me." I go down and I signed the log. He says, "You're now a member of the ship's company." That's how I made it.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
So then You're 17. You stop in Tampa, and you don't tell them, but you
and
leave. And
I had got hurt. I got hurt when these submarines were causing all this problem. They ran us. They ran our ship. A little Navy, actually, it was a fishing vessel that had been painted gray, kind of a harbor thing. They ran us in. They ran my ship, a Russian ship, an English ship, and a Greek ship, all allies at that time, into a little bay. Well, for we were in first, so we dropped our anchor, and then as these other ships came in behind us, they said, you're going to have to move further back into this harbor at nighttime, because we didn't. They told German submarines are out there. In the daytime, they had this one little tug, kind of a tugboat-like thing, and they had one ash can on the back that they could push over the side if there was a submarine. But anyway, they we dropped our hook. Now, when you drop your on old ships nowadays, modern day, you have hydraulic stuff, but in those days, when your anchor is pulled back up, that chain has to go somewhere, and it goes into what they call a chain locker. It's about the size of this carpet, little carpet I got down here. It's divided into two parts with a steel plate about 4 feet high. One's a port anchor, one's a starboard anchor. So as we had to pull our anchor back up, each link is cast iron about maybe 14 inches high and 6 inches wide. They're heavy. So when it's coming down, you have to guide those around until the anchor is all the way up. It's a lot of work.
Sure.
So they drop you in through a little booby hatch in the top. Mm-hmm. So, of course, being 16 years old and full of vim and vigor, they had me down in there doing that. I did that. So we moved back in further, dropped that hook again. Another ship came in, so they moved us back further. I'm down there again doing that, and all of a sudden, the port anchor was released. Turned out that the bosun was drunk operating the winch. All I could do was jump on top of the anchor that was already, and it was still coming in. So it piled up all over me, and the other one was slashing around. Finally, it quit both of them. A sailor gets the booby hatch out, comes down, disentangles me from this anchor chain. It was piled all over my leg and my arm. They pulled me up on deck, laid me out. They said, you shouldn't have allowed that guy to operate that winch when he was drunk. Anyway, we didn't have any corpsmen aboard, no medical. So they called over to an English ship, and they sent one of their guys over. He said, well, I haven't got any morphine to give you. Does anybody have any whiskey? Well, one of the guys had a bottle of Cuban rum. So he poured it all over my leg. That's the reason I walk with a limp now. I poured it all over my leg, got a pair of pliers-like things and pulled pieces of metal out of it. Then he gave me the rest of this rum, which I wasn't much of a drinker, but I drank it, battled it all up, and said, now when you get to a port, you're going to have to go see a doctor. He said, I put some sulfa drug on it. They didn't have penicillin early in those days. It wasn't until later on. So when I joined the Navy, they said, well, we can make you a third-class petty officer right now. So I went off to boot camp. I was teaching guys how to row boats, big farm boys, strong, but they didn't know how to row boats. So I was teaching them how to row boats and how to navigate.
Where was your boot camp?
It was at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. There's a huge lake up there. And for some reason or another, they made a boot camp up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, right next to the Canadian border.
They called it Farragut, I think, right?
Farragut.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Anyway, wolves were still running around. When we graduated, they came to us and they said, now, 50% of the company is automatically going to the armed guard. That's gunner mates aboard merchant ships. I said, fine, that's what I want. I had put in, they asked you for three choices. I wrote gunner's mate, an aerial gunner mate. In case I go, if I couldn't get on a ship, I'd get on an airplane. Mm-hmm. They said, well, half the company is going to the armed guard. The other half of the company are going to pharmacist school to be medics for the U.S. Marines. Because this is early in 1943. Marines were on Guadalcanal. So I said, I don't want to have shots and stuff like that. They said, there's a few people going to service schools. So they read off on my name, you're going to radio school. So I went in to see a young, what I call a school teacher officer. He had just graduated with a degree in social sciences or something, and they make them personnel officers. I said, they got me going to radio school. I don't want to go to radio school. He said, I don't care whether you want to go or not, that's where you're going. You got the highest score in anybody in the battalion on that test, that radio test. I said, sir, I did not take that test. I was out teaching these yo-yos how to row. He said, I don't care. It says that you got the highest score. So I get to radio school. Officer comes out, an experienced officer, submarine officer. But he was overage to go back in submarine, so they put him in charge of a school. The University of Colorado, they had a radio school, Navy. He said, if there's anybody here that doesn't intend, there was 100 of us, to do the very best job of radioman in the U.S. Navy, step forward now. I step forward. So he comes up to me. What's your problem? I have no problem, sir. I don't want to be a radioman. What do you want to do? I want to be a gunner's mate. Come up to my office as soon as we break formation. Yes, sir. I go up there. He says, you don't know anything about it. I said, yes, sir, I do. I've been a merchant seaman. I've already been to sea for almost a year. I know exactly what I want to do. Oh. Well, he said, do you know how we work this? I said, no. He said, depending on your rating in the class, when you graduate, the number one guy in the class, we put up on a chalkboard up there, the USS Lexington airplane carrier needs one radioman. A brand new destroyer in Charleston, South Carolina needs one radioman. Goes all the way down. He said, depending on how you do, you get your choice of duty. I said, okay. So I came out third in the class. Mm-hmm. So the first guy got his, second guy got his, third one came up, brand new destroyer out of Charleston, South Carolina, just finished its sea trials. It's going to the South Pacific. I said, that's for me. I said, fine. Oh, just a minute. They got a star alongside your name. I said, what does that mean? He said, you remember those civilian guys that came here, civilian clothes, asking for everybody who had some degree of college? I said, yeah. Well, they had them fill out a bunch of papers and stuff, yeah. Well, you're going with that unit. I said, I can't go to that unit. I don't have any college. I'm a high school dropout. He said, I don't care. They got you picked. So I go get on a train, troop train, send me to some place. A guy comes running out dressed in a Japanese uniform, jabbering in Japanese, American. Then he went into English. He said, you're now with the United States Naval Intelligence Organization. You're going to learn katakana Japanese. Swore us all in, top secret. During wartime, they can send you to prison for the rest of your life or they can shoot you. So you can't tell anybody this, not even your own parents, nobody. I then learned how to intercept Japanese radio traffic, and a lot of other things. Next thing I know, they came to us. They said, well, you haven't finished your course, but several of us had done so well. It's like music. Some people can get it, some people can't. Sure. Well, Morse code, to me, was easy. And I could type like a maniac already anyway. So he said, the Japanese have just bombed Dutch Harbor. At the same time, the Battle of Midway was going on. It was a diversion to get our troops up there. And they've also occupied an island called Attu in the Aleutian Change and another one called Kiska. We need 12 volunteers to go up there. So I was up there. And I spent my time up there primarily not actually shooting Japanese, but intercepting all of their radio traffic. We had broken the Japanese codes, naval codes. But anyway, so we did that kind of stuff. Well, one day, just before the Battle of Okinawa, Ensign Monroe, who was one of these guys he had taken off a corregidor and made an officer, nice guy, actually, good man. He said, okay, we're sending you somewhere else now. I said, where? Well, can't tell you. We're just going to send you to Pearl, and from Pearl you'll go out to South Pacific somewhere. I said, okay, but I understand you got an outfit operating behind the lines in China. And he said, yeah. I said, I want to go there. No, you can't go there. I said, why not? Well, you joined the Navy after the war started. Those guys that are there, every one of them were pre-war Navy guys. So they're all guys that are 41, 42, 43, 40 years old. They're experienced guys, not only in radio and katakana, but they've been around a long time. I said, that's where I want to go. You can't go. So we had some stuff we called a Lucian solution, which was a homemade form of wine. So I had some of that. So I wrote a letter to the Chief of Naval Intelligence, and I said, I told him my background. I said, I didn't join the Navy to go to Pearl Harbor to wait to be assigned to someplace. I want to go someplace where I can kill Japanese. I took it over to a merchant ship and had them mail it from the, because we had sensors, they wouldn't, during the war. So he mailed it. About a month went by, and Ensign Monroe calls me, and we're living in tents. He called me on a field phone, said, get up here. I got up there and he said, who do you know in Washington, D.C.? I said, I don't know anybody in Washington, D.C. He said, is your dad a high-ranking officer? I said, no. He was a private in the Army. He said, well, you got orders to immediately report to Op 20G in Washington, D.C. for further transfer to China. I said, oh? So I report there, and they said, okay, every morning you call in and give a code word. It was all fruits, like first day, orange, next day, lemon, grapefruit, stuff like that. Then he would say, no orders, no orders. They said, you have to go over to the Marine Corps and get qualified with the 45 caliber pistol. I said, I'm already qualified with it. Well, you have to do it again. So I go over there, and I did. Some Marine girls were watching this. So I went over to one of them. I said, she said, I see where you already qualified. I said, yeah. My dad had a 45 he forgot to turn in from World War I, and I used to practice. And so to make a long story short, we made a date. She was a stenographer, actually, at Marine Corps headquarters. So she said, well, I'm not too sure I want to go on a date with you. I was pretty coming on too strong. But she said, I have a girlfriend that said she wants to go out with you. I said, I don't want to go with your girlfriend. I want to go with you. So we had a date. And then I used to go over and see her, and she'd say, are you a deserter? I said, why? She said, it don't make any difference what time I tell you when she's off duty, you're available. Well, then one day I said, well, I'm catching a plane. I'm going someplace. Can I come and see you off? I said, yeah. She came to the Naval Air Station, kissed her goodbye. She said, well, you'll write. I said, no, I can't write. Well, you can phone me. I can't phone you. She said, it sounds like a line. I said, no, it's not a line. I can't do it. I got on a plane, flew to Calcutta, India, got off the plane, another sociologist come out, said, you guys come over to my quarters. He had just had a shack. There was 12 of us. Said, you're going over to relieve those guys that are over there. You have to fly over the hump, 15,000 feet or something. But he said, you don't have to fly over there. I said, well, sir, there's no way we can walk over there. He said, no, you'll hear about it. We dropped a bomb on a city in Japan, blew the city down and killed everybody in it. I said, how long you been over here in the sun? He said, no, it's called an atom bomb. And next week, if they don't quit, we're going to drop another one. And they did. And I flew back, engaged my girlfriend. We got married. We were married 57 and a half years. The sheriff retired, so I was elected sheriff for 4 years, then another 4 years, then another 4 years, and then I retired. And they had been asking me to teach at Fresno State, so I did. I did that until I was 65. It was a good thing because I had to teach them the academic aspects, but I could tell them real true stories about law enforcement.
He's written about some of those real true stories in a book I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's called Arson Investigation, but it also includes other cases from his years as sheriff of Madera County in California. One that received national attention was the Chowchilla school bus kidnapping. He's got an entire chapter on that. And before we're done on the radio today, some of the secrets Ed had to keep while serving in naval intelligence that he's finally allowed to talk about now. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and another fascinating adventure today with 98-year-old Ed Bates, a veteran of both the Merchant Marine and the Navy in World War II. He ended up in a special naval intelligence unit called Op 20G in Washington, D.C., which is where he met his late wife, Frida, who ended up being quite a help to him in his law enforcement career as a county sheriff and coroner as well. You know, when you talked about going into naval intelligence, you highlighted the stakes for you, that because it was a time of war, if you violated the secrecy, it could cost you your life. I think the statute of limitations should be up on a lot of that stuff. Can you give us some examples of some of the kind of information that you were privy to or some of the secret things you did?
Well, one of the things that I just got a letter from NSA, because I had to clear it with them first. They said, I can tell this story, but I can't change it in any respect. Can't give you too many details. I was in Hawaii when the Korean War broke out in the Navy. A young petty officer come running over to me and said, hey, I've got a Soviet radar station sending a DOL message. DOL to the Soviets, it's now Russian, but Soviets at that time, meant air alert, air alert, air alert. Now we had airplanes flying 12 miles out from Vladivostok, Russian. And we had, before then, the USS Pueblo, which was captured by the North Koreans. You captured all of our secret data, all of our secret stuff, and all of our men, which they furnished to the Soviets. Anyway, this guy is sending that, and he said, this Soviet operator is so scared that his Morse code is unintelligible, even though it was in Russian. He said, can you help me? So I ran over, picked up his earphones, tuned it in, And it was obvious that this man was scared to death. So one of our airplanes must be pretty close. They have shot down several of our planes. Chinese did too, with all of our people aboard. You don't hear much about that. But so pretty soon, a KGB, that's Russian secret police agent, came on that circuit. Sent him a signal to put a qualified operator on watch because they're trying to get radar on this American plane so they could shoot it down. So then this guy still tried to send. He couldn't. It was unintelligible. But I stayed with it. I got little parts of it. Then pretty soon somebody got on and sent the message in code, in cipher, just a series of numbers. Didn't mean anything, but I copied it. Then all of a sudden, he was gone. Another guy came in, sent the message in plain language. In other words, it broke the Russian code. Now, the National Security Agency spends billions of dollars trying to break the Russian codes. And this crazy guy broke it, trying to send it. So right away, I sent this information off to the National Security Agency. Then I got off duty. When I came back on duty that night, we had a message. Congratulations to Operator EB, that was me, and to the station. Of all of the intercept stations that the Army, Navy, Air Force, everybody has, you were the only station that copied this information that broke their code. It gave the exact data on all of their radar. Subsequently, I learned that a U.S. Air Force reconnaissance airplane on such a mission had disappeared. They've never found it to this day. Now, whether that was that one, don't know. But those kind of things happen.
Yeah, I'm always struck by, with all the stories I hear from guys like you, the stories of the things that actually happen sometimes pale in comparison to considering what could have happened.
Yeah, that's it. And maybe some that have happened that we don't know about.
Yeah.
Because Americans, unfortunately, my culture is pre-war. I'm thinking of magazines on Saturday Evening Post painted by a man and his wife, and little children holding hands going to church, an officer talking to a young lad, both of them, the lad looking at the officer with admiration, and the officer with his arm around the young guy. All kinds of a Girl Scout saluting the American flag, things that indicated what a fine country it is. Maybe guys on United Farm Workers on a strike, that was okay, that's legal. Everything, showing American life. Nowadays, like I said, the officers aren't even going to stop if they're burning down the precinct. What's happened?
That's a big question, but I do think you've experienced at least one thing that maybe restored your hope for America, or a reminder that people do value your service. And you got to go on the honor flight to Washington, D.C. In fact, I believe you took a picture of your wife with you there. What do you remember about that experience, your honor flight?
Well, it was particularly meaningful to me because that, of course, Washington, D.C. is where I met my wife. One of the tours that they take you is to the Air Force, the Navy, the Marines, and so forth. As we were going up to the Air Force in a bus to look at their Air Force Memorial for World War II, there was a sign down on a road just as you started up, painted red and yellow marking, Marine Corps, and it said Henderson Hall. That's where my wife was stationed. And that's where I used to visit her. And so I had her picture and mine with me, so that every place we visited there, some of them she hadn't visited, of course, because they were after the war. Mm-hmm. But places we had gone together, the flag ceremony, when she was a corporal, part of her duties was guarding that area.
At Arlington, at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier?
Yeah, Arlington. Yeah, Henderson Hall was just right there at that same location. So they had to take turns doing that kind of duty with a detail of people watching it when it wasn't being guarded. So anyway, I reminisced everything that we had seen and done there. Of course, I was a typical young sailor, and I found out we'd go to a nice place to eat, and she wouldn't drink, and she didn't smoke, and she was a straight arrow. And then when I became sheriff, former sheriff had had a secretary, but I had no secretary. Frieda said, well, I'll come down and do it for you. So she typed my letters for me. And then I found out the detectives, they weren't sending in crime reports, which are required by the attorney general, so that they could determine what kind of crimes are occurring and where they're occurring. They weren't doing it. She worked for 6 years for free for detectives doing that for them. She was a real trooper.
I'm sure we could sit here for hours, and you've got lots of stories, but
oh, yeah.
I have a couple more questions for you. One, you know, have you ever thought, if I didn't drink that Aleutian solution and write that crazy letter, that I never would have met my wife?
I have thought about that, as a matter of fact. That's true. Yeah, because I wrote to the admiral in charge of all naval intelligence. His name was Zacharias. Very famous guy. I don't know whether you ever saw it or somebody else might have seen it in between, but nobody ever said nothing to me, but there I was.
The Lord works in mysterious ways?
Indeed. In fact, he made me a good Christian. I used to think of a Christian as the old-fashioned thing. Now I lay me down to sleep, pray the Lord my soul to keep. And I was thinking of the Lord Jesus as a guy standing over me watching with a sword. And I was thinking, well, when the time comes that he's going after the devil, I want to be along his side with another sword. And I still want to be that way.
As you celebrate 98 years, when you think back over 98 years, is there something you'd say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Well, probably the idea that this really truly was a case, as far as I'm concerned, a fight in a war again. Only it was a war instead of a war against a foreign enemy. I was convinced there's two kinds of people, good people and bad people. And when I was made a deputy sheriff, the only test that he gave me, I gave him my military record. He said, are you a good shot? I said, yeah, I shoot expert. Can you handle yourself in a fight? Yes, indeed. Do you know the difference between a good guy and a bad guy? Yes, I do. Okay, here's what I want you to do. Go after the bad guys, leave the good guys alone. So in 29 and a half years, I never gave a single citation to anybody. I've warned them. I've called the highway patrol to take drunk drivers in. They get an attaboy when they do that. In my case, if an officer did it, he had to go testify, and we weren't paid overtime, so I had to give them time off. I couldn't do that. So we turned everything like that over to the highway patrol. I wasn't going to go out and stop grandma because the baby threw a candy wrapper out. No, that's a good guy. It has to be done. There has to be people that do that. And many of the guys driving through stoplights and drunk and so, are bad guys. But my job was to go out and catch good guys, and it tickled the hell out of me to catch guys that were bad guys.
And one more, and then if there's anything you'd like to add, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. You know, thank you for serving our country and keeping us safe for so many years. Is there anything that you haven't done yet or that hasn't happened in 98 years that you're still kind of looking forward to or hoping for?
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting Jesus. My first thought was, Jesus, are you sure I'm supposed to be here? No, I've looked up every single thing I've ever done in my life as an adventure. And most of all of them turned out good. And so whatever happens from now on, it's an adventure. And I'm willing to live with that. I've always had a real good attitude about everything. Everything's going to be good. The only thing I'm adding now is where I said before there were good guys and bad guys, there are evil people. Evil. They're more concerned about themselves, their power, and the money. Greed is probably the single, that when I was teaching criminology, I had to teach, you know, the reason people commit crime is because they've been overprotected by their mothers. They've been rejected by their fathers. They're victims of social, cultural, ethnic, economic, psychological, environmental, racial problems. Well, it's true that some of those factors do. But the truth of the matter is, the reason people commit crime is because there's a desire to commit crime, plus the opportunity to commit crime. So if you find somebody with a desire to commit crime and the opportunity, it's going to happen. It's divided by R, which is repression. So if you want to steal a watermelon from my watermelon field, and I'm standing there with a shotgun loaded with rock salt, your desire factor goes way down. So, and on the desire factor, most of your desire to stay out of trouble comes from your home life. The problem we have today, I think, this is a personal thing, that all those other factors, of course, influence things. And we live in such a fast, rapid society. In my generation, even if you didn't have much to eat, the whole family sat down and we would talk. What happened to you in school today? Dad, what happened today at work? And everybody had something to say, and we all knew everything. We all were able to talk about it. Today, because of economics, both people have to work generally just to get by. That's not necessarily the best situation for children, but it's a fact of life. Then, of course, you get, as you see is happening in Harvard and Yale, you're getting college professors who were hippies during the 60s. And so what did they have written on the side of their van? God is dead. If it feels good, do it. Greed is good. Hell no, I won't go. Those people are now college professors teaching our youth. I've often thought the propaganda minister for Hitler said, if you tell a big enough lie often enough, people will believe it. And that's what they did. But he took people who were, they had a worse depression even than we did. He furnished them free radios that were only tuned to two stations. One was propaganda station and the other music. People liked music and they listened to this propaganda station. So little children heard this over and over and over and over. Jews were bad, bad, bad. Slavs were bad. You have to kill them, so forth. I can't help but think many of the school teachers today have been raised in a different culture. They teach it to our kids. They teach about how we took advantage of the Native Americans, and we did. Took advantage of black people that were slaves, and we did. And they take advantage of poor people compared to rich people, and we do. But in spite of those things, everybody wants to come to America. It's the land of opportunity. You have a chance, at least, to get above that. You can't just teach the bad things unless you also point out the advantages. And I think that we live in a society where it's more popular to talk about the bad things. That's why I'm willing to go back in the service. Put me on the side of a hill with a scoped rifle. Even with my bad leg, I can still do it. See? Yeah, of course I can.
I'm not going to argue with them on that. And if you want to, do so at your own risk. Happy 98th birthday to Ed Bates, who hit that number November 3rd. And thanks to longtime listener Brian Weldon, who has long encouraged me to pay this unique World War II veteran a visit. So glad I did. Again, you can find photos, a short video, and a link to Ed Bates' book at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.